Welcome to HBTV, November 1st, 2023. I'm Harry Binswanger, the HB in HBTV. I'm a professor of philosophy who advocates Ayn Rand's philosophy. And joining me today is Rozi Ginsberg of the Ayn Rand Center of the United Kingdom. Welcome, Rozi.
Hi, Harry. Thanks for doing this again, and thanks for having me on. Let me just quickly say to people who have questions or comments, we, of course, appreciate all super chats and appreciate engagement in the live chat. If you want your question answered or your statement read, please do send a super chat of £20 or more. We will get to that.
But there's a minimum for super chat of £20.
Yes, people can send super chats to support us for lower amounts. But if they want their comments or questions read out, then it is a £20 minimum.
And I saw the pound is in terms of dollars. This morning was $1.21, so it's about $25 US.
Yeah.
£20 in the UK. Okay, our topic today is lethal language used against Israel. And my screen just went funny. That's why I wanted Rozi, who knows Israel. And it, what I guess you are, you a UK citizen now, Rozi?
I'm not a citizen. I'm a permanent resident here. I'm an Austrian citizen, actually, but I'm also an Israeli citizen, and I spent most of my life in Israel.
Okay, good. So I will be calling upon him for factual details behind my overall mountaintop view of what's going on in this struggle between Israel and Hamas, and even to describe it as a struggle between Israel and Hamas is wrong. That's one of the themes of our talk. Why is it not a struggle between Israel and Hamas? Because that suggests some kind of moral equivalence. It's the attempt of Hamas to achieve its goals of destroying Israel and imposing a theocratic dictatorship on the territory, an Islamic theocratic dictatorship on the territory of Israel. And Israel is not in a struggle against Hamas. It is the side that is trying to defend itself and will defend itself and should defend itself against the attempt to destroy it. So it is, World War II was not a struggle between the Allies and the Axis. It was an attempt of the Nazis to take over as much of the world as they could, and the fight by the forces of right, which the Allies represented, to stop them and end their inhuman barbarism. It's exactly the same today, with Israel in the role of the Allies and Hamas and its supporters, including especially Iran, in the role of the Nazis. And it's not a coincidence that during World War II, the Arab countries favored Hitler and the Nazis. They were aligned. They didn't formally become an Axis power, but they were aligned and supported, especially morally, the Hitler-Nazi attempt to destroy civilization in the Western world. So that's one example, not calling it a struggle between A and B, but calling it an attempt to stop the destruction wreaked by B. That's one example of how language turns into value judgments It comes from value judgments and it turns into value judgments and can sabotage your thinking. You have to understand that the concepts are not carved in some mountaintop. The concepts are formed by human beings, and words are just names for concepts. So when we talk about the terms I'm going to talk about, such as apartheid, oppression, occupation, I won't go through all of them. You have to understand that somebody decided to call it that and to divide things up in a certain way. It wasn't the voice of God. It wasn't always that way. It wasn't carved into a mountaintop. It was a human decision. And that decision was right or wrong. And in these cases, it's wrong. Those are the cases that are hampering Israel's Israel's resolve to crush the forces of evil, which is what it should be doing and should have the full support of every civilized country in the world. So let's take up one of them, one of these terms that is based upon a misconceptualization, apartheid. The Israeli state has been called an apartheid state. What does apartheid mean? It was a term, I think, from the Afrikaans language to denote a policy of South Africa of consciously, deliberately, legally excluding Blacks from all kinds of participation in society and depriving them of their rights. Apartheid was a government's order that a certain group, based on race in this case, could not own property, could not trade property with other groups, it could not be in the legislature, could not do this and could not do that, depriving them of their rights. So it was a rights-violating policy in law. You know, they had tests in South Africa of who was a Black, who was a Negro that was to be deprived of his rights. And there were such things, it was read to me years and years ago. The official would take a comb and run it through the hair of the person. And if it was curly enough, then he was Negro. To use the term, I think they used that. And he didn't have rights. So we're talking about a bureaucratically enforced governmental policy of systematic deprivation of rights. But that's not how it's used in regard to Israel. In regard to Israel, it simply means that Israelis don't like Palestinians, which isn't even true. But it's somehow supposed to be like depriving them of their rights if they are not fully embraced. In fact, it's probably worse than that, Razi. You probably know it's probably the anti-apartheid that they want is to give them privileges, violating the rights of Israelis, probably. Is that true?
It depends on who you ask. Yeah, some people have the idea that, of course, if people in Gaza and the West Bank could vote in Israeli elections, they would vote Israel out of existence. There's also the preference that, a Palestinian state is formed and then they have their own state. And yeah, it takes many forms, but like you mentioned, this is a term mostly being used as a rhetorical device against Israel and not actually as a meaningful, fully thought out concept.
The way it's defined is apartheid is any system of government that I oppose, I being the speaker. The next one I want to take up is oppression. No, wait, I really didn't finish with apartheid. There is no legal apartheid. There is no government policy of excluding the rights of Palestinians or anybody else in Israel. And this is not appreciated by the, at least the American people. I've had people tell me in America, Americans tell me that in Israel, Arabs or Palestinians, unfavored minorities, can't own property, can't vote. So, and I found a website that has these faces on it, which I'm now trying to share my screen. And, oh, here it is. Okay. All right. I hope you see. Yeah, I think you're seeing, or we're seeing, the faces of 18 people, 17 of which are actual Arabs, and the eighth, this guy here in the middle, Dov Kanin, is an Israeli Jew who's a communist, but these others are Arabs, or Palestinians, Arabs, that are in the Knesset, in the legislature, and are in a caucus. Now, this was from 2015, which is the most recent website I can find. But so much for the idea that the rights of non-Jews are not respected in Israel. Here are the members of the Knesset that are in the joint Arab list. They're a caucus in the Knesset, the legislature of Israel. Do you think there are any Jews in the legislature or what passes for it in Gaza? Are there even any Jews residing in Gaza? Razia, maybe you can speak to that.
I doubt there are any Jews residing in Gaza. I do want to give some context for this joint Arab list. So the this was a few parties coming together, a few so-called Arab parties, and you can see the names there. So Hadash is the Communist Party. So they always have a token Jew on their list, who's usually in third place on the list. That is number eight in this. Yeah, that's Dov Hanin. You see the Islamic Movement. You see Balad, which Balad and Ta'al are the nationalist movement. So this was a advocates of different types of tyrannical systems united into one party to help them get elected and cross the threshold, the minimum threshold of votes needed to get into the Knesset. It wasn't a long lasting union, but all these parties are still, I don't know if all these parties, but some of these parties are still represented, and those who aren't represented because they didn't get elected, not because they
get elected. Won. So this puts the lie to the idea that Palestinians cannot vote in Israel, that the ones who live in Israel are deprived of their political rights. There they are, members, not just voting, but members of the Knesset in 2015. Okay, that's what I wanted to say about apartheid. Do you think there were any blacks in the South African legislature in the apartheid era? No, there definitely were not. Just like there were no black congressmen in the United States in the era of Jim Crow. There could have been in the North, but I don't believe there were. And certainly there weren't in the South, which had the Jim Crow laws. So there's no equivalence here. Jews are an enemy in the Palestinian-controlled areas. Palestinians living in Israel have full rights, and their it used to be. Now things are probably changing now due to the atrocities of October 7th, but it used to be that there were friendships between particular Palestinians and particular Israelis that lived in that, lived together, lived in the same neighborhood. Okay, oppression. You hear it said, yeah, the atrocities of the Gazans, the Palestinians committed against the Jews on October 7th are terrible, but you have to understand the long, long history of oppression that sparked this. What oppression? What is oppression? Oppression, as these people use it, means they're not given free everything that they would want, and their desire to rule you is resisted. So the oppression that they've been subject to, but from Israel, is that Israel didn't want to surrender their rights and either let the Palestinians take over and kill them or put them in concentration camps or convert to Islam. That was the oppression. You are not behaving as I want you to behave. That's the oppression, because there was no oppression. There was the offer of a tremendous value. Palestinians and Arabs living in Israel have many fold higher standards of living than those living in the, quote, occupied territories, living in Gaza or the West Bank. And this is well known and undisputed, that you're much better off, you're much less subject to deprivation, or that's not the right word, to poverty, if you live in Israel. You're much better off. It's a better life. So the oppression, which means tyranny, which means the violation of your rights, must consist, if they're using that, in you didn't surrender your rights to them. You didn't let them oppress you. And that's oppressing to them. They want to oppress you. You know, a murderer wants to murder you, but you fight back. That's oppression. You've got to let me murder you, or else I'm oppressed. I can't express myself. So the suggestion is that Israelis came and took land from Palestinians, held them down, treated them as slaves and servants, didn't let them vote. And, you know, in the South, the slaves weren't even allowed to learn the alphabet. You got whipped if you tried to learn to read in the South. So the suggestion is that somehow this was done to the Palestinians. Now, it was done to the Palestinians, in a sense, by the other Arab countries. Why, after from 1948 to the present, 75 years, there have been these refugees, these Palestinian refugees? Why? Because the surrounding Arab states won't let them in. It's not that Israel held them in some kind of bondage. It's that they couldn't go anywhere else. They weren't allowed to immigrate into any of the other Arab states. So to call oppression the offering of a better life with protection for your rights and a high standard of living, to call that oppression is to suggest that oppression is, I can't murder you. I'm held down. I can't murder you. Occupation, the occupied lands. Israel got its original mandate from Britain, and it was ratified by the UN, and they were recognized as a country in 1948. Immediately, what was it, six Arab countries surrounding attacked them? So they fought and they prevented themselves from being deprived of the land that they had bought. Few people realize that the lands that Israelis live on and got were bought. There's a table on the web with the number of acres that were bought in the various years, starting way before the formation of Israel. They did not roll tanks in and take land. Now, it is true that after being attacked again in, I think, the 67 war, they took lands to defend themselves. And Gaza is part of that, although things have gone back and forth. But Israel has taken land, the West Bank and so forth, the Golan Heights, which they thought was necessary to protect themselves from future attacks. Now, do you think, let's just pause on this, the non-equivalence, do you think that Israel, month after month, year after year, has been firing rockets into, say, Egypt or Syria or Gaza after they gave it away to the Palestinian Authority? Do you think little Jewish children have been wearing suicide vests and sent into marketplaces in Gaza to blow themselves up just because that way that some Gazans can be killed? Yet that's what's been done throughout the period from at least the Intifada, which was, God, in the 70s, and probably before that, constant murders, mass murders, if they could, of Israelis for the crime of being Israeli, of being Jewish, by the innocent Palestinians against Israelis who only wanted to be left alone, both individually and as a country. So where's the occupation? Where's the oppression? Where's the apartheid? These are just smear words, or else terms redefined to mean their opposites.
Harry, just a quick note on the idea of Gaza being occupied. So Gaza, that's land that Israel gained at the 1967 war, as well as the Sinai Desert from Egypt. So this was Egyptian-controlled land. Israel signed a peace deal with Egypt in 1979. Egypt, as part of that, wanted the Sinai Desert back. Gaza Strip, not so much. You know, they weren't that interested in that. But this was not occupied from a Palestinian state that, you know, supposedly existed, and then Israel took it over. It was
Egypt. Was Egypt. Yeah, that's a point worth emphasizing. And now let's look at the two big ones. The first is genocide. And this will integrate a lot of them. Razi told me yesterday or the day before that genocide is the word he sees most often hurled at what the Israelis are doing. And this is the most colossal inversion in human history. The term genocide was coined to deal with what Hitler was doing to the Jews. He was attempting to wipe out Jews as a people, as a genus, as a class, all of them. He only succeeded in killing 6 million. So from that, what the Jews suffered from and fled to Israel to avoid is now being charged against them. It's hideously evil. Just the fact that they would dare to call Egypt's self-defense actions genocide shows the utter intellectual bankruptcy and moral depravity of the opposition to Israel. this is, I don't know what to liken it to, like the victims of Jack the Ripper being called knife artists and slashers, but it's much worse than that, because 6 million Jews were killed in an attempt to wipe out the genus, the class of Judaism in Germany and the territories it controlled. Israel has not attempted to wipe out anybody. It's attempted to defend itself, not to, well, let's go kill Arabs. Let's get rid of Islam, which is it so different from the truth, the facts, that you've turned genocide again into its opposite. Genocide means resisting genocide. It's a projection. The Palestinians and Arabs and Islamists in general want to kill as many Jews as possible. They feel Hitler didn't kill enough. And they are the genocidal maniacs. The resistance to them, the striving not to be killed and to fight back, is called genocide. The shoe is on the other foot, to use a much too benign metaphor. So, I mean, that is the most depraved twisting of language I've ever seen. It's just factually false and morally depraved. Now, something that is, let me tie that up with what I've been saying before I go to the next one, innocent. The nature of the entity determines its actions. Ayn Rand says, the nature of an action is caused and determined by the nature of the entities that act. What is Hamas's nature? If we're talking about genocide, genocide is its nature. Its goal, if you look at dictionary.com, is to incorporate, is the word they use, present day Israel into an Islamic state. That's its goal. That's what it exists to do, to destroy Israel. And what does incorporate mean there? It means either to drive all the Jews out, or even better from their standpoint, to murder all the Jews, the millions of Jews, was it 9 million now who live, or 8 million, who live in Israel, beating Hitler. They want to murder. They want genocide. That's what they exist to do. And what is their domestic policy? Hamas. Now, what is Hamas's domestic policy? Because it's never talked about. Dictatorship, Islamic dictatorship. They don't recognize the rights of the people living in Palestine. They're not, look at building a hospital over, or building their Hamas's troop centers under a hospital. Do you think that is an action of an entity that respects life? No, it's an actions of an entity that wants to invade and kill. Now look at Israel. What is Israel doing? Is Israel the same kind of guilt? Is Israel constantly barraging the Arab territories, sending in martyrs to blow up things? Are they trying to, before this, these atrocities, were they sending tanks in? Were they in any way evincing any goal other than to create wealth and glorify technology? No. Israel is a Western civilized, life-loving country. the Arab states headed by Iran are death worshipers. After 9/11, one Islamist says, "We're going to win because you Americans love life and we love death." And that's true, but that's why we're going to win. And there's nothing stopping Israel from wiping out all resistance, including Iran, other than the moral weakness of the West, which has to do with it not being self-assertive enough, not being self-confident enough, having self-doubt and trying to be Mr. Nice Guy time after decade after decade. Why is there a Palestinian Authority? Israel gave away the Gaza that it had won in military self-defense to the Palestinian Authority in the hope that that would satisfy them and now they would be left alone. So the only thing that's saving the Arabs from destruction is not any kind of military weakness, but moral weakness, lack of self-doubt, really. So if one entity wants to destroy you and the other entity wants to live and form a startup and write super software and celebrate life, l'chaim, to life is the toast, what is the right way to form your concepts? You can't form a concept like oppression that covers the desire to be at peace, create wealth for everyone to get wealthy and have great technology, save lives through medicine, and someone who says the Quran, which is the voice of God through the prophet, says on judgment day, if a Jew tries to hide behind a tree, the tree will say to the Arab, there's a Jew trying to hide behind me, kill him. Can those two be treated as in any way equal? That, oh, well, there's two points of view. And yeah, there were bad things they did, but they've suffered a lot. They weren't able to do even more bad things. And you know how horrible that is when you can't kill as many people as you'd like to. You're oppressed. So the final term I want to discuss is innocent. You live in a territory, you are responsible for the sins of the government internationally, for the sins of that government. If you live in Gaza and you see what happens, and you don't protest, you don't try to escape. Now, granted, Egypt closed the border, so it makes it a little hard. Makes it very hard, but there are ways. You are responsible. You are sanctioning it. So the relationship of the, quote, innocents in Palestine, the ordinary Palestine, to their government, Hamas, is the same as the relationship of the German people under Hitler to the actions of the Hitler regime. They can't say, that's not us, that's our government. Sure, we supported Hitler, he won the election. You know, he was voted in, granted he didn't have a majority, he had only a plurality, but he was voted in and Germans loved him. They loved him. Stalin, do you know when Stalin died? Stalin, who sent many more people to their deaths, many more, like 10 times what Hitler did. When Stalin died, people wept in the streets. Putin is a Stalin admirer. He's bringing back the honor of that mass butcher So it a dictatorship cannot survive more than a few years if the populace really opposes it. It has to rise and stay in power through the support of the populace. We've seen regimes in the last 30, over the last 30 years, where they had to give up power because 100,000, a million citizens would mass in the square demanding their ouster. They could not stand up to that. We've seen that happen. And it didn't happen in Gaza. So the Palestinians are guilty. The Palestinians are guilty. They're not innocent. We should not make a distinction, as Biden suggested, between Hamas and the Palestinians who put Hamas in power and support them. So that this whole idea of, you know, it's very wrong to kill the innocent. It's not wrong to kill the innocents if they support the murder and atrocities, decapitating babies in the ward, infant ward at the hospital, if they support putting military bases underneath hospitals, if they support cutting off the legs of a man and sending him out with a bomb concealed to appeal to the humanitarian, sending him in a wheelchair, I guess, humanitarian sympathies of the Israelis so he could get near them and blow them up. There are no innocents in a dictatorship fighting against a free country. Technically, there are. I mean, you know, a baby is born is technically innocent. But A, the guilt, if that baby dies, is on the aggressor, not on the person trying to defend himself against aggression. And second of all, anyone over the age of about 9 in there knows what's going on in Gaza and is responsible and has either got to rise up and rebel or get out. That's his moral responsibility. There was one other thing about genocide that I wanted to say, and it slipped out of my mind. So, go ahead.
I had a question about genocide. About the use of the term, but I want to just thank our super chatters quickly. Thank you, Walter, Bonnie, Equal to Reality, Vandy, and Wes, and thank you, Sahib, for the very generous super chat. He says, "Salute to Harry and Razi." Thank you, and thank you for the support. So, Harry, the word genocide, again, in this, as you mentioned, I've seen it more than any other word being used against Israel. Now, I'm wondering how the mind of a person who uses this word in this context operates. I mean, we look at if you look at the facts and even the selective information that such people no doubt believe. I mean, you and I, and I think most of our audience agree that Israel should fight in a different way to how it's fighting. But what we do know is that Israel goes out of its way to avoid hitting civilians, even when terrorists are hiding behind civilians. The people using the term genocide know that as well. If they believe, and I assume they believe Hamas's numbers on various different things, then there are 2 million people living in Gaza. There are about 9,000 people who died in 3.5 weeks of a military operation. How do you look at those numbers? Again, Hamas numbers, and knowing the military capabilities of Israel, that wiping Gaza out completely would have been possible in day one. How does that mind operate? I mean, when they're not talking about this war, the same mind has to deal with the rest of life. And I'm wondering how such a mind, I'm guessing they're not going to be rational on everything else and then just happen to be particularly rational on this.
That's an issue of epistemology and morality. Most people are what Ayn Rand called second-handers. Most people are not original thinkers, and I don't mean that they don't come up with new theories of their own. Most people just chant what they're indoctrinated. You can't even call it what their significant others tell them is true. They just say it. And the leadership has decided that this term genocide has a big negative aura around it. They don't need to understand that that negative aura came from crimes against the Jews, some of whom are still living in Israel. They just know that's a good term. If you can accuse somebody of genocide, to any extent that your audience believes it, it really blackens those people that you apply it to. And so the leaders say, yeah, this is, accuse them of genocide. We accuse them of anything, accuse them of biological warfare. Why not? People don't like biological warfare. So anything that's highly charged as negative, they apply that term, that label, with no understanding of the source or meaning of it. And most people just follow what they're told, which is why this outbreak of pro-Palestinian sentiment in America is on college campuses, because the professors are telling them, this is what you should believe. This is the truth. Any educated, sophisticated person knows that Israel is a criminal state occupying, you know, and they tell them that. They tell them that for a long time in every class. And unless you're a thinking person, let me change it. If you're an abject, mindless horde follower, as most people are, unfortunately, that's the horde that you follow, because that's what the sophisticated people, your professors, tell you. Now, it's not a matter of debate. There was just yesterday an article in a newspaper about 100 professors at some Ivy League school, it might have been Columbia, signed a document about the need for a, quote, humanitarian pause, which means let's let Hamas get away and find someplace to hide and regroup. And it was thinly disguised as an objective humanitarian thing, but it's 100 professors at a school signed a petition designed to help the Palestinians against Israel. And if you read into it at all, that is, you read down, it's a long letter, you see the attack on Israel in it. They're definitely anti-Israel sentiment. So this has been going on for a long time. I saw the earlier version of it, much milder. The student rebellion of 1968. I was at Columbia. I fought against, in many ways, the sequel to the Berkeley Rebellion of 1964. It wasn't a student rebellion. It was a professor-led rebellion, communists created by Marxist teachers who wanted to bring down America. So this is just the worst version of that. The faculties of the universities are all on the wrong side. Well, the humanities faculties are all corrupt. They're all captives of the philosophy of mysticism and collectivism and self-sacrifice that was taught by German philosophers, climaxing in Immanuel Kant, the most influential philosopher of the last 300 years, maybe the last 1,000 years. So it's no accident. And just to show you that it's not due to any other reason, it's not that, well, you know, some people say universities are staffed by people who feel inferior and they want to elevate themselves, so they attack the masses and they take controversial opinions because they can't do anything to earn a real living. So it's psychologically motivated. Well, in 1776 and thereabouts, the hotbed of American individualist capitalist thought was Harvard and Yale and William and Mary. But just think, Harvard, there were only about, I don't know, six universities, they weren't called universities and colleges in America. And they were pro-capitalist, pro-individualist, anti-Britain, anti-violation of rights. So it's not something about being a professor that makes you leftist. It's a consequence of the philosophy that has dominated the academic world for 200 years now, 250 years. So it's the ideas from the ivory tower that filtered down into the opinion leaders' minds and from there into the public minds. And that's why you find that the progressives are all the more educated, you know, indoctrinated types, and the conservatives and anti-progressives are more redneck types. It's because they've been less exposed to the poisonous ideas that come from the academic world. So the battle is fundamentally philosophical, and that's why Israel is in a terrible shape, in a terrible position, because the moral certainty that they need, that their cause is just and that they needn't bother with world opinion, is impossible on a German philosophic base, the philosophy of Kant, Hegel, Marx, people you've never heard of like Schleiermacher Meister Eckhart, going back. I mean, there are all kinds of Leibniz you've probably heard of. All German philosophy, and I don't mean this restricted to Germany, but Germany's the headquarters of anti-man, anti-life, anti-rights, anti-capitalist, and now anti-Israeli philosophy and ideas. And that's what is responsible for the fact that Israel is still under attack after all these years. So I don't know if some, do we have a comment in the super chat that we should take?
There was only the one by Sahib, which we read earlier. And there are no questions in the super chat.
The Sahib, which sounds like a Arab name, would be a living refutation of the ideas of Immanuel Kant, because he's not, his mind is not run by filters built into him, but he's able to think for himself. And he has free will, which Kant thought existed only in another unperceivable world, not in this world where you live. So he is the poster boy for Aristotelian objectivist philosophy, simply by the fact of not going along with what he no doubt was taught, or they attempted to instill in him.
Yeah, a few days ago,
I don't know Sahib, but I'm just going by the name.
a few days ago on one of the shows, we were talking about, you know, all the gays for Palestine, Jews for Palestine organizations. And we thought a rational alternative to that would be Arabs for Israel. So if anybody wants to start that organization, we will, you know, have you on the channel.
He'd be in danger. That would place him in danger. There's a tenet of Islam. If you're raised as an Islamist or accepted at any point in your life, and then you change your mind, there's a death sentence on you. The apostate should be killed. Jews should be killed, but in a way, they're better. The apostates knew the good as they see it and turned against it treasonously. The Jews were just, I don't know how they think of the Jews. It's just racial collectivism. And notice just one final shot. The left, which is so anti-racist, and you should be anti-racist, but they are, everything is racist. And they pride themselves, every one of them, being the only person in the universe who's not a racist, maybe. Critical race study says anybody who's white is racist, which is a racist doctrine. Those people who are racism, 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 have nothing to say about the racism of the Palestinians against the Jews. I mean, the amount of Jew hatred is in the Arab world is phenomenal. And now there's growing evidence of it on the left in the United States. I mean, a lot of evidence. So thank you very much for this grim assessment of things. And I hope to be back with a more positive message in a future HBTV. And thank you, Rosie, for joining me.
Thanks, Harry.